All right. Good morning, faithful listeners. You are tuning in to a brand new podcast being released by the Tolkien Professor. So without further ado, my name is Dave Kale, Director of Programming of Middle Earth Network Radio, and I would like to introduce you to the incomparable, most widely recognized internet Tolkien expert, Professor Corey Olson of Washington College. So I give you the Tolkien Professor.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. Well, ever since the Hobbit trailer came out, there has been sort of a special enthusiasm for people to talk about, not just to talk about the films and what's going on in the films, but to talk about how they're connected with the books. And of course, these are questions that people have been having ever since the first casting announcements were being made last year. Near the beginning of last year. Many Tolkien fans kind of understandably concerned, what exactly is going on here? What is this? What can we see about the film? And more importantly, at least more importantly for Tolkien fans, how does this seem to connect to the books? And I've had a couple conversations about this, and, people have been wanting to talk about the Hobbit trailer. Ever since the Hobbit trailer came out, I've been locked away in a small closet finishing my Hobbit book. But that is done now. So I have emerged from solitary confinement and am ready to talk Hobbit film stuff. And I actually think it's really interesting stuff to talk about. I think that there are some really fascinating things that I think we can see the New Zealand people planning and doing, which I think are going to be very interesting. So my friend Dave Kale from Middle Earth Network Radio and I have decided to get together and host a new series, which will be broadcasting here on Middle Earth Network Radio, and we will be posting also to my Tolkien Professor podcast feed. And the series is called Riddles in the Dark, and we're going to be going through sort of topic by topic, looking at different aspects of the Hobbit films and the adaptation of the book, and really kind of talking about the books and some of the background, which seems to be working, being connected and adapted in the films. And we're going to be doing a series of basically kind of predictions and comments on, what it seems like the New Zealand people are planning, and what we think about that. So we're going to be talking about various Hobbit-related topics, especially connected with the film, and at first, of course, especially connected with the trailer, since I haven't had too much of a chance to actually talk about that yet. And in today's first episode, we're going to talk about Thror and Thran. That is, we're going to talk about Thorin's parents, dad and granddad, and what we think is going on, what role they might have in the films. We can tell that they are going to appear in the films. We know that they've both been cast. And so what really is there? And I would say, just sort of to kind of start off, the overall issue, I think, kind of the biggest source of underlying anxiety for a lot of Tolkien fans about how the Hobbit film stuff is that, sort of the big question, how is Peter Jackson going to make two epic films out of this short little children's book? The Hobbit is in no way two-thirds as long as The Lord of the Rings. So since The Hobbit is only like less than a sixth as long as the Lord of the Rings itself, how is it that we're going to get two-thirds of the film that we got in The Lord of the Rings? It seems like, oh man, he's going to be adding all this extra material. It's going to be totally unrecognizable. That, I think, is anyways one of the major fears that Tolkien fans have about the film. And I have to say, the primary thing, and I've said this kind of thing a couple times before, I'm not worried about that, actually. I think it was an anxiety that I had too, an uncertainty that I had way back before it was being, before any information was actually to be had. But everything I've seen come out of New Zealand suggests to me that they're actually doing a really good job about that. So I think that, The number one thing that we can see is that Peter Jackson is plainly going to be unfolding many of the background stories which Tolkien himself connected to The Hobbit. I said in my little one-page comment on the trailer back in December that, you know, to me, you want the Cliff Notes version of the film. What you should do is read The Quest for Erebor, because that is obviously, the core of a lot of what they're doing. And Peter Jackson in a recent interview commented on that explicitly. How Tolkien, of course, did a lot of adaptation of The Hobbit and a lot of connection of The Hobbit to the Lord of the Rings story as it came to be developed many years after The Hobbit had been published. And a lot of that material is what they're using. So the Hobbit story that they're telling isn't just the 270-page children's book that was published in 1937. The story of The Hobbit that they're telling is the story of The Hobbit as it came later on to be in Tolkien's mind after he had integrated it into the larger story that he came to write. And that seems to me a perfectly defensible kind of thing to do. And what's more, and I would say, and this is where I'm sort of moving back towards our specific topic of the day, to thinking about Thror and Thran, and that is, it's not only in the later materials, it's not just the Quest for Erebor and the sort of the later integration and adaptation and additions that Tolkien himself did. We also see a lot of background story peeking in around the corners in The Hobbit itself. And this is something that I was actually kind of noticing in particular this my last time through The Hobbit as I was writing my book manuscript. One moment that really jumped out at me when I was working through my book, was in chapter 4, that is, Overhill and Underhill, when they're captured by the goblins. The moment in chapter 4 when they come before the great goblin and the great goblin recognizes Thorin. And I think that's a moment that really struck me in a new way when I was reading it this last time, because we're told about the history of Thorin's family back in chapter 1. We're told he's an immensely important dwarf, and we're told that, you know, we hear about his grandfather and his father and the fact that they had a battle with goblins in the Mines of Moria. Now in 1937, with the faintest idea what the Mines of Moria are, it's an almost meaningless thing. And it sounds like it could be, you know, it sounds like it might have been, you know, maybe a small skirmish of some kind. We get no clear sense that this was a huge war between the dwarves and the goblins, which culminated at the great battle of Azan-ul-Bazar. That version of it didn't exist. But even in The Hobbit itself, we get this new revelation, as we go through. You know, we get these few references which kind of suggest to us in chapter 1 that there's backstory, but we don't get all that much about Thorin. When we're introduced to Thorin and we're told he's immensely important, that seems primarily to mean that he's a pompous jerk, because that's how he acts to Bilbo. You know, he's obviously full of himself, but we don't really know any justification for that. Then we get to Rivendell. And at Rivendell, we learn about Durin's Day. And Thorin's little speech about Durin, you know, that he was the father of the dwarves and his first ancestor, shows us, okay, all right, well, actually, all right, it seems like Thorin is, you know, his family is an important family and goes back to antiquity. In fact, we get the first glimpse there that Thorin might be actually part not only of an important family, but in one sense, kind of the ruling or first family of all of the dwarves. So that's kind of an interesting tidbit that is revealed to us in chapter 3. But as I said, to me, in chapter 4, when the great goblin recognizes his name, and clearly knows him and his family by reputation, that's one of the first clear glimpses that we get as readers that that Thorin and his, that this was actually a really big deal. That far and wide through the wild and up and down the Misty Mountains, the stories of Thorin and his father and his grandfather have been told and retold, and it really is a big deal. And that's sort of the first time that we actually, I think, are prompted to see that Thorin is actually, he's not just full of himself. He actually is a kind of celebrity, though his celebrity among the goblins is kind of questionable.
Yeah, I hadn't caught that last time I read this. That's a pretty interesting point. It's one of those things that it's very easy to let go by if you don't really think about
it.
You have to be in that sort of larger Tolkien world mindset, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's really neat. And then, of course, Bjorn confirms it when he meets Bjorn in Chapter 7. Then Bjorn also recognizes Thorin's name and has heard of him and approves, because apparently he's from a family of legendary goblin haters and goblin murder, you know, goblin killers, which is awesome. And, you know, that's like all the commendation he needs in Bjorn's book. But again, it's like this, those two pieces, the recognition of the Great Goblin first and of Bjorn second, are the clear evidences that we get to connect Thorin to, well, to this wider story, to this sort of big deal. So again, even in The Hobbit itself, even in the 1937 Hobbit itself, we have this glimpse of a backstory, this glimpse of Thorin is kind of a big deal, his dad was kind of a big deal, his grandfather was kind of a big deal, and that the war between the dwarves and the goblins was huge and significant, and that there is something about their family. Why was he captured by the necromancer and brought into Dol Guldur? You know, why was he captured and held in prison and apparently tortured to death? And we don't know. We're never told that in The Hobbit itself. But again, there's this sense of mystery. These are not just wanderers. There is a bigger story here. So I think it obviously, actually, to tell that story changes it. It's much different to actually put on screen the Battle of Azanul-Bazar and try to place the whole thing in actual context. And that gets us to sort of the meat of our debate today, which is, given that Thror and Thran have been cast, they're obviously going to appear on screen. So the topic of speculation for today is, how exactly are they going to appear on screen? What exactly is Peter Jackson going to do with that? Are we talking about a flashback? Are we going to get a full treatment? What do we think, Dave? What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I was sort of hoping maybe for those listeners who haven't read through the appendices of The Lord of the Rings with a fine-tooth comb, which, if you're a Tolkien professor fan and you haven't done that yet, well, that's hard to imagine that anyone like that exists. But maybe you can give us a quick rundown on Thror and Thrain, and sort of what kind of material does Peter Jackson have to work with? I just want to comment. One of the things I'm most excited about with these films is getting into the dwarves stuff. I mean, that's always whenever I wrap up The Return of the King and I get into the appendices, or even sometimes just sort of randomly, I'll decide I feel like going and reading of the dwarves in the appendices, because there's some really neat stories, and we don't get nearly enough stuff on the dwarves in The Lord of the Rings in particular. Or in any of the books,
yeah,
really.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, even in The Silmarillion, they're kind of fascinating and very elusive. I mean, you know, they come into several stories. Of course, most importantly, the story of the Nauglamir and the downfall of Doriath. But you know, we get this sort of sense of a little sense of dwarven culture, though The Silmarillion also kind of gives the impression that we're getting a fairly limited and possibly biased elf version of it. But anyway, there's obviously more to be heard about that. And I agree. Yeah, it's, to me, in the appendices, it's one of the sections that really stands out. In fact, I remember being kind of surprised when I first got there. That is, okay, so like the first time I'm reading Appendix A, and I didn't read it the first time I read The Lord of the Rings. I distinctly remember not reading the appendices when I first read The Lord of the Rings when I was a kid, which was probably smart, or at least fortunate. But anyway, I remember when I first finally did dig into the appendices. You know, the Appendix A starts with the discussion of the history of Numenor and Gondor, essentially. And that was kind of a no-brainer, right? I mean, we get all these references to Elendil and who really was Elendil and Isildur and what is the history of Gondor. Faramir tells us about the history of Gondor. We get some things. But it's nice to hear the whole story. And I was always very interested to hear the whole story of Gondor and of Numenor behind it. And of course, the story of the Northern Kingdom and how did the Dúnedain, you know, fall and just become the Rangers and all that stuff. So that's all, you know, like, okay, that's like no-brainer appendix content, right? And then the second part of Appendix A which is the story of the Rohirrim. Great. Okay. All these things about Eorl the Young. And I mean, hearing the story about how Eorl the Young got his horse and how he came to come down and to hear even snatches of some of the really cool stories that are alluded to so indirectly, or so briefly in the books themselves, especially the story of Helm Hammerhand. And throughout the chapter on Helm's Deep, we get these references to him, which are so tantalizing, and we know nothing about him until the appendices. So we get all that stuff. And again, that also seems perfectly logical, and that's great. And then we get of Durin's folk. And that was, I remember finding that kind of unexpected. I was like, ooh, I didn't, that was not a no-brainer. I wasn't sure we were going to get that. Because they're so tangentially involved in the Lord of the Rings. I mean, you get Gimli, of course, but other than Gimli's own personal involvement, and some references in the Council of, Glowin's testimony before the Council of Elrond and the brief discussion of what's going on in the Lonely Mountain. Other than that, we get nothing about the dwarves in the Lord of the Rings. Right. I mean, they're not really characters in the Lord of the Rings.
You don't have a company of dwarves marching off to, say, the Battle of the Hornburg.
Right, exactly. Though Gimli wishes that they would come.
Yes.
That was always the reaction I had to the arrival of Haldir and the elves at Helm's Deep in the movie. Was of course there's that Gimli and Legolas in the book have that conversation where they each wish that some of their own folk would come. And it was the first thing I thought of. I remember when Haldir and the elves march up, I was like, hey, look, it's Legolas's wish fulfillment. Are there going to be dwarves too? Is Gimli's wish going to also come true?
You must have been disappointed.
Yes, but then Gimli's wish doesn't come true. But anyway, so in some ways it was kind of counterintuitive that he even put in the appendix on Durin's folk in the Lord of the Rings, but I was awfully glad he did. And it is really interesting to learn more about them. And some of the main stuff that we get is this particular back history. And it seems pretty clear that the reason that he did it is that he was already thinking through the Hobbit stuff and expanding on the connection, kind of recontextualizing a lot of the Hobbit story and the Hobbit material in the context of the Lord of the Rings. And, okay, so Thran and Thror. So Thror was the king under the mountain. He was the king in the Lonely Mountain when Smaug came. So he and Thran and Thorin go into exile together. And when they go into exile, there are lots and lots of dwarves. There's some people, for instance, who have asked, okay, like, how was Thorin planning to repopulate the Lonely Mountain, during The Hobbit? Like, so he's going to go back and somehow Smaug is going to get killed, though he never really thinks that through. And he's going to reclaim his kingdom under the mountain. I've had some listeners and readers who have asked, well, like, what's his plan then? I mean, he's got like 13 boys. Like, how exactly is he planning to rebuild a kingdom with 13 male dwarves? Of course, the answer to that is there were lots of them who were scattered, and most of them are living up in the Iron Hills with Dan, and some of them are back in the Blue Mountains where Thorin's home was prior to the Hobbits starting. So there are actually more of the people, but they're scattered. Thror and Thran are not ruling a kingdom in exile. The people are scattered all over the place. The dwarves of Erebor are scattered all over the place. And the kings in exile now are living much more humble lives. Okay, so now what happens with there are two major events which are clearly sort of epic fodder for film stuff. And that is first, Thror. So Thror goes a little mad when he gets old. And he decides he's going to go back and reclaim Moria. And as we learn in The Lord of the Rings, the Mines of Moria were the greatest kingdom of the dwarves that ever existed. Khazad-dûm was the great realm of the people of Durin. That is really his ancestral home. The Lonely Mountain was itself kind of a kingdom in exile when they were kicked out of Moria by the Balrog. So Khazad-dûm is his real ancestral home, but it's even going to be harder to reclaim than the Lofty Mountain. But Thror, the aged Thror, decides that he's going to waltz into Moria and basically reclaim it all by himself. And that's how the Goblin War starts, because there is a Goblin King who is ruling from Moria, whose name is Azog. And Thror marches himself in, and he comes with one servant, and the servant prudently waits outside while Thror waltzes in single-handedly to reclaim Moria. And he's killed and decapitated, and his body is chucked out, and Azog carves his name on the forehead of the dead body of Thror and tells his servant to take the head home as a message to his other people that they shouldn't come begging around to Moria anymore. This then prompts all of the dwarves to swear vengeance. To swear vengeance on the goblins and on Azog in particular. And they have this enormous war, all of the dwarf kingdoms. Thorin's family is only one of the seven clans of dwarves that exist throughout the world. But they put like an APB out for all of the dwarves everywhere, in Middle Earth to gather together and fight a war of vengeance for the killing of the heir of Durin, which is what Thor was. They're like, this is an enormous insult, and dwarves don't take even small insults well. And this was a huge insult, so they're gonna avenge it. So they wage this long-term war. Now, again, we don't really learn about this. The only reference to this is in chapter one. Well, I guess it's the first reference to this is in chapter one of The Hobbit, where Thorin says, "We have long ago paid the goblins of Moria." You know, they've taken vengeance on them for killing Thror. And so they have this long war. And then, you know, as Tolkien develops it later on, and as we're told about it in the appendix in particular, it's this war that happens up and down the Misty Mountains in every cavern and stronghold of the orcs until finally Azog and the last of his goblins are brought to bay in Moria and in the gates of Moria. And there's a battle. There's the huge and final culminating battle in the valley, which is called as an Ulbazar by the dwarves, or Nenduhirion by the elves. It's the valley right in front of the main gates of Moria, where the fellowship comes out when they flee from Moria. And in this battle, this is the battle where Thorin got his nickname, Oakenshield, because his shield breaks and he cuts a branch off of a tree and holds the tree branch in his left hand to use as both a shield and a club, and that's where he gets his name. Dan is called Dan Ironfoot, and again, that's from, he gets that nickname from this battle when he puts his foot on the neck of Azog himself. So it was huge, massive casualties among the dwarves. They slaughtered almost all of the goblins of the Misty Mountains, it turns out. So this battle, I mean, the Battle of Azanulbazar is in some ways a bigger battle even than the Battle of Five Armies. In one way, it was more climactic. It was more awful. It was less spectacular because there were fewer people involved, and we don't get any werebears, and we don't get any eagles, and there are no elves and of any gender. And so, you know, and there are no hobbits or wizards, but it was just dwarves and orcs. But it was huge. It was a massive battle. And they kill Azog and take vengeance and then go home. Thran at that point is saying, hey, Thran, who gets his eye put out during the battle, we're told. So now one-eyed Thran says, okay, let's claim Moria. It's now ours. And, the rest of the dwarves say, dude, there's still like, well, they don't know what the Balrog is, but Durin's Bane is still in there. We're not going in there. So they don't, but Thran still has, and this is again, this is a later thing. Obviously the Rings of Power didn't exist when Tolkien wrote The Hobbit. He hadn't thought of that yet. When he's writing this later on, we're told Thran still has the last of the seven rings of the dwarves. The seven rings of the dwarves have all been lost except this last one. Thror had it and he gave it to Thran before Thror went to Moria. But Thran still has it. That's why we're told, again, though no explanation is ever given in The Hobbit itself, that's why Thran is captured by the Necromancer, by Sauron, because Sauron is trying to reclaim the last of the Dwarven Rings, and succeeds. He captures Thran, takes him to Dol Guldur, takes his ring away in torment, and then Thrain dies in prison, though apparently he somehow manages to hide this map and key that Gandalf gets from him when he meets him there. So how and where he concealed that on his person, I don't really want to speculate. I don't think I want a visual on that, actually. But anyway.
You can never really count on the servants of Sauron to do a thorough job of searching their prisoners, or just security in general at their prisons is pretty bad.
Yes, it seems to be. And that's even when they don't all slaughter each other.
Right, there's also that.
which they are only too prone to do. But yes, I mean, that will be actually a really interesting challenge, I think, will be depicting that, if they do, in fact, depict it in any detail, how it is that Thrain is able to conceal the map and key, and how it is that he is able to get it to Gandalf. One of the things that I have been hoping for, you know, basically ever since the Hobbit film has been discussed, I have been really hoping for some really good Gandalf and Dol Guldur scenes. And I suspect from looking at the trailer that I'm going to get them. I think that, you know, there were so many Gandalf solo shots that I am hopeful that some of them are going to be Gandalf and Dol Guldur. And so I think that we might get some good meaty bits there, which would be fantastic. I would be really interested to see that, because it's clearly a big part of the bigger story. And obviously, as well, thinking about it simply from a movie storytelling standpoint, it makes a really great opening gambit, that in the sense of, if the culmination of the story of The Hobbit, in one sense, is going to be the kicking out of Sauron from Dol Guldur and his flight to Moria, you know, so the final conflict between the White Council and Sauron in Mirkwood, the invasion of Gandalf into Dol Guldur, which is done in order to confirm that the necromancer really is Sauron, taking shape again, is sort of the perfect setup for that, you know, the perfect complement for that we get, you know, Gandalf solo invasion at the beginning, you know, and then that kind of being bracketed by the final kind of invasion of the White Council there at the end. So I think, you know, that would work great. I think that would be really cool. And so I think, as far as how are we going to see Thrain in the film, I think we're clearly going to see him in prison. How exactly Jackson's going to treat that, I'm not really sure. I mean, I think that there's certainly going to be some stuff about his ring being taken away. That's obviously going to be a big deal. They made such a big deal about the, you know, sort of the power of the rings over people that I assume they're going to play that up.
What does Gandalf tell us about the meeting with Thrain? I'm trying to remember. I feel like we get bits and pieces. There's a little bit in The Hobbit. And if I recall correctly, I think he even talks about this meeting in the Council of Elrond, right?
What he says about it in The Hobbit, when he's telling Thorin where he got the map, he says, "I tried to save your father, but it was too late. He was witless and wandering and had forgotten almost everything except the map and the key." Now, of course,
interesting that he had forgotten the ring, but
right, exactly. Which, of course, you know, again, this is in The Hobbit when the ring didn't exist. So
correct.
Tolkien has to kind of undo that later on, because obviously the last holder of the last of the Dwarven Rings of Power isn't going to have totally forgotten that. In fact, that's going to be something that I would suspect Peter Jackson's going to reverse, basically, and that he's going to be totally obsessed with the ring itself. In fact, one of the challenges, I think, is going to be the kind of apparent irrelevance of the map and key to the ring. That is, like, if he's just had his ring of power taken away from him, is he, you know, why is he even going to be thinking about the map and the key? Because they're not relevant to the ring of power. I think that that's going to be an interesting thing to kind of manage for Peter Jackson and company. Especially with the choice that they made in the first film to really play up much more than happens in the book, I think, to play up the allure of the ring and the obsessiveness. Now, this is not the ring of, this is not the One Ring that we're talking about. This is the Dwarven Ring, and it has different powers, and maybe they will take the opportunity to make some different choices and, you know, not make Thran into a kind of, you know, dwarfish golem, you know, sitting there saying, they've taken my precious. Like, you know, it doesn't have to go that way. And they have an excuse to not make it go that way. But I will be interested to see if they don't go that way. Exactly what direction do they go with it? Because clearly the thing that the Ring of Power, the Dwarven Ring of Power, is associated with in the Lord of the Rings is the desire for gold. So you think about how berserk Thorin goes at the end with his obsessiveness, his obsessive possessiveness towards the gold and the treasure after Smaug is dead. Well, the Ring of Power, one of the plain negative impacts that it has on dwarves, as we're told, is that it inflames their desire for gold. So, you know, how do you manifest that, especially for a dwarf who's, you know, in rags in prison? He's not exactly in Thorin's position where he's got a heap of gold and he's sitting on it. What does it look like when you take away the ring which was inflaming his desire for gold? I'm not really sure. As I said, they were very almost over the top in how they were depicting the kind of addictive nature of the Ring of Power, of the One Ring in the Lord of the Rings films. It'll be interesting, even just the question of how big of a player is the Dwarven Ring going to be in the film?
Yes.
How much is that going to come up at all? I'm not really sure. I mean, it's possible. I could even imagine them cutting it, because it is a complexity which is going to be difficult, and it takes away the emphasis from the quest for the Lonely Mountain.
Yep.
You know, it makes that like, well, okay, our Ring of Power is gone, and that's what really sucks. But, like, Thorin, here's a consolation prize. Go reclaim Erebor. I mean, like, that's not going to work very well. So you know, if they don't want it to sound like that, how are they going to handle it? So, yeah, I mean, I could see him cutting it, I guess, perhaps.
Yeah, or you could imagine them depicting Gandalf as making a choice to withhold that information. Because the dwarves at this point, in fact, isn't this true right up until the Council of Elrond that the dwarves hold the mistaken perception that that Thror took the ring with him to Moria when he was killed by Azog, and so he lost it in Moria.
Exactly.
And indeed, that's part of the motivation behind Balin trying to recapture Moria, hoping to find some rings
exactly.
there.
Yep. They're hoping to find the ring they were looking for it on the body of Azog. They thought that if Azog had taken it from Thror, that he would have it on him. Mm-hmm. And so they were disappointed not to find it on his body. But yes, they didn't even know that Thrain had it at all. And they certainly didn't know that the necromancer had taken it back. So that is definitely what's going on. Though again, it's another one of those delightful ways in which Tolkien doesn't just, when he was revising, he didn't just change the stuff that he'd done before. He makes use of the, you know, when he thinks of new storylines, which were totally not a part of the original conception, he uses the fact that they weren't part of the conception as part of the story, right? So in The Hobbit, there's no reference to the Dwarven Ring. And in the revised version, it's not like, oh crap, now I got to go back and rewrite The Hobbit so that I add in all these references to the Dwarven Ring. Instead, he makes the fact that they never talk about it part of the story, right? Gandalf never did mention, in fact, that Thran had lost the Dwarven Ring. It didn't come up, and maybe, you know, Balin, who's right there, you know, if he'd known that, it could have saved him a lot of time and difficulty. Right. But it's, you know, we just find out later that everyone has been all secretive about it.
Right. I think we need to do an entire episode at some point on rings in The Hobbit and
definitely
both the One Ring and the Dwarven Ring. So I'm going to steer us back toward Thrain. Any reactions to the scenes from the trailer that are purportedly Thran apparently fighting Gandalf.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. I mean,
you're not buying it, huh?
Well, let me just say I'm not completely convinced. I mean, I see the line of reasoning that says, you know, who else could it be? But I'm not. Yeah, I mean, it's so short. I mean, it's like 2 seconds that, like, when Gandalf whacks the long-haired, gray-haired dude with his staff. And who is that? Is that Thran? Maybe it is. I can imagine. I mean, okay. If you operate on the premise that that's definitely Thran, can I make sense of it? Yeah, I think I can make some sense of it, you know, to say, like, okay, you know, he's witless and wandering, Gandalf says, right? So, I mean, he's completely crazed from having his ring taken away. So maybe he's attacking Gandalf in a kind of an amped up version of what almost happened between Frodo and Sam when Sam rescues Frodo from the Tower of Cir Ithungol, right? When, you know, when Sam goes all, give it to me, it's mine, you know, you can't have it, you thief. You know, that maybe when, you know, here's poor Gandalf being like, hey, Thran, gosh, here you are in prison, can I help? And Thran's like, you took my ring, give it back! You know, like, I can totally, like, maybe, and unlike with Frodo and Sam, it actually comes to blow, you know, poor Gandalf has to club Thran over the head in order to back him off. I mean, I can imagine this. It would be one way to handle the, you know, kind of extremity of, you know, sort of spiritual and emotional, you know, sort of torment that Thran has been driven to in prison and everything. But one reason, the primary reason I'm skeptical about that moment in the trailer is that it takes place outside. It seems to take place outside from the lighting, looking at it, and I'm looking at a freeze frame of it right now. It's dark and it seems to be taking place in a ruin, and there's some what looks like definitely orcish metalwork and stuff around them. So it seems to be not just like an old Numenorean ruin or something, but definitely orcish work. But they see it looks like, I mean, maybe it's just the lighting that they have makes it look like external moonlight or something, but it looks like external moonlight to me. It looks like he is in a ruin somewhere and not in a prison cell. Certainly that doesn't look like a cell to me. So unless he's already, you know, unless the movie is going to have him actually in process of busting Thran out of prison, until something obviously goes awry in this plan. And, you know, maybe that's what's happening, but that's why I'm skeptical, because the setting, he does not look like this is happening in a cell. And I don't see what reason we have to think that we're going to ever see Thran outside of a cell.
Yeah,
in the Hobbit film, unless we see a flashback, to Azanulbazar, and we get the one-eyed Thran. So, or something. But
so the
anyway,
one thing I might
so
add
that's
to
why
that,
I'm skeptical about that.
The one thing I might add to that would be that there's been a lot of discussion about the sort of the setting depicted there. I think particularly over on the very very good and detailed analysis that the OneRing.net did, where they mention and they may have had information from the production on this. I can't recall that. It could be that the dungeons of Dol Guldur are actually outside. They mention like that there's hanging cages for prisoners and things like this, which is an interesting idea. Maybe this is just you know, maybe Thran is on his you know, he gets to be out in the yard at this time of day.
So he's outside the count, you know, like shooting hoops with the other inmates, yeah, and stuff, you know, during their rec hour. Yeah, no, yeah. I can see that.
That's or possible. He's on work detail.
Exactly. Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, just off camera is, you know, the truck behind them with the porta potty strapped to it. Yeah. Maybe. I mean, you know, that's possible. I can see that, I guess. It's a little bit, I would find that a puzzling decision. I mean, nothing says deep, dark prison to me like the dungeons of the necromancer in Dol Guldur. I mean, I mean, like hanging cages, like I can see hanging cages, you know, like a nice fresh air environment, a little harder for me to imagine that that's what Sauron has cooked up for his victims.
Certainly isn't the mental image that I think I had when I read it. Like, you're really imagining pits.
Right. Well, especially since the elves of Mirkwood themselves, you know, put them in underground prisons. So it's like, okay, so the elves are like, you know, darker and
more
underground.
Than Sauron.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, there is that issue in the Council of Elrond, right? When, you know, when Glowin is like, you are less kind to me, you know, than you were to Gollum. But again, but that's different. See, it's one thing for the elves to say like, hey, we will keep him in, you know, we'll let Gollum out for a rec hour and let him climb trees and stuff. But it's hard to imagine the necromancer doing the same. I mean, it's just possible. I mean, I mean, goodness knows if we're getting winks and nods from the OneRing.net that's actually what might be going on in production. You know, who am I to contradict them? But it's still, you know, I'm not sure.
We don't have to approve, though.
No, I don't have to approve, and I certainly think. It would be very difficult for me to get behind Dungeons of the Necromancer, which are, you know, bright and airy. That just doesn't seem right at all. But, you know, maybe I can't think, you know, again, watching Gandalf, you know, club that old bearded guy in the head again and again. I can't think of who else it could be exactly.
that was going to be my question. So we don't like the idea that that's Thrawn. Thran. Every time I say his name, I say it differently.
Yes.
If we don't like the idea that that's Thran, who else would we imagine it might be? Other than, I guess it could be a completely made up character.
Yeah. I mean, it would pretty much have to be. I mean, we don't,
it's certainly not Radagast the Brown. That's one of the names.
Yeah, no, I hope not. I hope, oh, goodness knows, I hope we don't get, like, you know, old wizard fight round two in The Hobbit. No, and I don't think, I don't, no. Oh, goodness, I'd never even thought of that. No, I don't think so. But I think that, well, I mean, it is possible that it is just, that it could be just somebody else. And obviously that kind of is sort of a, from a speculation standpoint, kind of a dead end. Because if they invented somebody completely new, then, well, we have no evidence from the books to talk about who that might be now, do we? But yeah, I mean, there's no reference to anybody being in the dungeons of Dol Guldur, well, and surviving, other than Thran, not that Thran survives, but he is the only one who is mentioned as being a prisoner there, though certainly other people will have been taken. He won't have an empty dungeon other than Thran, but yeah. So, I mean, I can see, I wouldn't be shocked. I think it could be well done, but again, what, you know, why would Gandalf be beating the crap out of Thran if it is Thran? What, I think if it is Thran, I would have to imagine that they're going to be going all, you know, you've taken my precious with Thran there. I mean, I can't see really any other explanation for Gandalf beating on him.
Gandalf's not even, it's not even like he's sort of, you know, kind of dodging Thran's shots and saying, it's me, your old friend Gandalf. He's swinging, man. He's taking swings.
Yeah.
He's fighting back.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he completely takes him out. So yeah, no, it's now, of course, then, you know, the other question would be, if it's not Thran, if it's some random, you know, like Joe the prisoner that they invent, why would it make the trailer? And I think possibly that what we're getting here is just, you know, like a Gandalf action shot. But I don't know. I do find that kind of puzzling. And I said, I don't have a better theory than Thran.
It is an interesting question. And of course, we shouldn't discount the possibility that this scene won't even make it into the film.
Right. Right. Yeah. Who knows? Who knows?
Maybe they're going to look at this and say, oh, yeah. Or maybe they'll listen to this podcast and grieve. Oh, this is a terrible right. idea. We've got to go back and redo all the dungeon scenes.
Yeah. Yes. Put a roof on it. Come on now. Put a roof on it. I can imagine, you know, them saying, like, we don't want just your standard, like, torch-lit, dank dungeon. Like, that's been done so many times. We want something visually striking and different. You know, it might work. I mean, it might work on film.
Interesting point. That's something that I think when fans such as ourselves are, you know, imagining how we would like to see things, there is – our priorities are frequently different from those of people making a film. You know, we're like, well, I want it to be as true as possible to the story, and they may be making decisions, you know, not just how to tell the story, but even what's going to look good on film. You know, like, will it look good if it's Gandalf in a tunnel or in a dank hole talking to this guy? Nah. You know, but if we put him up in the sky, we can do lighting, we can have them fighting, and, you know, get some more Gandalf action shots. So that's something that I often forget, that this, you know, that's probably one of the most important, that's probably one of their highest priorities, I think, in planning a lot of these scenes. How's it going to look? What's the visuals going to be like?
And this is one of the things, you know, that you always kind of have to come back to, which I think is kind of a cruel reality for a lot of Tolkien fans to face, is that although there might be some things which you can look at the films and say, okay, I don't think that they've been true to Tolkien's vision there. I think that, you know, I would have wanted to see it adapted differently because that doesn't make sense in the context of the books. And yet it may very well be quite true that if they had stayed truer to the book in that decision, it would have made a much worse film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's just like, it's a cruel reality, but it's one of the realities of adapting. We're not just doing a modern rewrite of Tolkien's books. What we're seeing here is an adaptation to a totally different genre with different storytelling conventions and different storytelling priorities as well. When you do something visually on film, there are some choices which make perfect sense and work really well in the book and would not work well on film. So, I mean, it's just like that is a reality that has to be confronted. Now, I don't think that means that every difference is justified. But I do think that there are things like that where even if I could say, okay, objectively speaking, an open air prison for the necromancer, like I can't justify it from the books. I mean, like, it really doesn't make any sense to me. But you know what? Maybe it will work on screen and not be, you know, an actual distraction or an actual aberration.
Right.
So we should get to get to our specific prediction here, because I think we're ready to talk about how this will appear.
Yep. I agree. So, here's the question of the day. We originally were going to just go with will we see Thrain or not? But I think we can be pretty confident that we're going to see Thrain. He's been cast. So is Thror, which is fascinating. There's always the possibility that these scenes could be cut and they'll end up being special feature, you know, extended edition stuff.
But we
will see it in some fashion on the screen. I think the more interesting question this brings up is how is this, the story of Thrain going to be integrated into the story? So we're certainly going to see him on screen in some fashion. So my question is, Thrain's backstory, how he ended up in Dol Guldur. So we're going to see him in Dol Guldur. I think we can be pretty confident that we will see that somehow, and we may have already seen him. But his backstory, how he ended up in Dol Guldur, which I think will probably get in there in some fashion, how will the backstory of Thrain be explored in the film? And we have four choices. Choice A is we'll get a full flashback showing us his journey and his capture on the edge of Mirkwood. Choice B is we'll just have exposition from Gandalf to Thorin, maybe. He'll tell him a little bit. We'll see Gandalf and Thorin in Bree, being served beer by Butterbur, and Gandalf telling Thorin some of this. Exposition from Thorin to others, to his company. This is choice C. We'll just have exposition from Thorin to others, or maybe to Bilbo, telling the story of what happened to Thrawn. Or option D, none of the above. It'll either just be sort of a pithy mention. Oh yeah, Thran was on his way to the last mountain, you know, to the Lonely Mountain, and he was captured. And then we actually get the scene of him in, you know, Gandalf meeting him in Dol Guldur. Or it'll just be left out entirely. We'll just start with, oh yeah, he was a prisoner of the Necromancer. So those are the four options. We'll get a full flashback showing his journey and his capture on the edge of Mirkwood, or at least parts of it. B is exposition from Gandalf to Thorin. C is exposition from Thorin to others. D, none of the above. It'll just be left out or mentioned, superficially in passing. What do you think?
Okay. I think, okay. And so the question is not about Gandalf meeting with Thran, but about Thran's capture by Sauron itself.
Yeah, I think that's, in my opinion, that's the more interesting question at this point. I mean, we know we're going to see Gandalf in Dol Guldur. Maybe how it'll be executed, there'll be some question about that. But but the real question is, what about the other stuff? Will we get to see scenes of Thran before he was captured?
I think... I'm going to go with A. Now, I think it's going to be short. I don't think we're going to get, you know, 15 minutes of Thran's capture. But I'm going to go with A. I'm going to go with, not just it's happening in exposition. And it's happening in exposition. We're talking about not only Gandalf just telling the story, but like the way that Gandalf's escape from Orthanc is done in The Lord of the Rings, right? Where Gandalf is sitting there at Frodo's bedside and Frodo is like, where were you? And then we get this, you know, Gandalf's own internal flashback.
Yes.
Of, you know, and then, you know, him coming back in Rivendell being like, I was delayed, right?
Yeah. I will count that. I would count that as A. I think that counts as a flashback. Exposition to me is just,
telling the story.
Yeah, them sitting in Bag End, you know, after having sung the song or something, and Thorin smoking on a pipe and telling Bilbo about how, you know, all the various abuses that his people have suffered at the hands of the rest of the world, and mentioning, you know, and talking about Thran, but we don't visually see Thran being taken, or Thran's company waking up in the morning on the edge of Mirkwood saying, "Where's Thran?" So
right. Now, I think A. I think we're gonna get some flashback of it, and the reason I think that is that if we're going to, as you say, it looks like we're going to get Gandalf and Dol Guldur. If that whole thing were gonna be exposition, that is, if the story were going to follow more closely just the story in the published Hobbit, and the beginning and the story and the movie were really to begin, you know, opening credits is Gandalf showing up in Hobbiton and Bilbo smoking his pipe. I mean, if that were to be, and I don't think that's how the movie is going to start. But if that were to be how the movie would start, I would say that we would get the whole thing in exposition. But since we're going to get Gandalf in Dol Guldur, I think we're going to get a more substantive, it might be short. We might only get a little bit about Thran's capture. But I think we're going to get some more substantive, because I think that would be strange. It would make sense. It would be consistent for Gandalf to narrate the whole thing. But I think we're going to get to see it on screen. So I think, you know, especially since it's also a way to connect other characters. Balin and Dwalin were both there. They were Thran's companions. They were sitting around the campfire, and they were the guys who were saying, "Dude, where's Thran gone?" And they were hunting for him. So what it provides, therefore, is an opportunity. Again, we don't learn that until Appendix A of The Lord of the Rings. But what it provides Peter Jackson, therefore, is an opportunity to give us more personal connection with some dwarf who is not Thorin. And so we can get, essentially it can count as backstory for Balin and Dwalin, their own recollections there, so that when we see them in Bag End, we'll recognize them. Oh man, yeah, that's like the poor old guy who was with Thran when he was snatched. So yeah, so I'm going A.
All right. I like the best part about this, and then this was my hope with most of these questions is that there will be widespread disagreement.
Yes, you always want widespread disagreement.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it won't be very interesting if we, and we'll talk about this a little bit in a second, if we and our other analysts, if we all end up saying the same thing about each and every one of these questions, then it won't be particularly interesting. So it'll be more interesting if we disagree. I guess this is where things get tricky. I'm going to go with, which shall I choose? I'm going to go with B, exposition from Gandalf. No, C, exposition from Thorin to others. I'm going to go with Thorin's recounting this story to Bilbo. Because as you pointed out, I think Thorin would be the source of this information since there were other dwarves there. That this wouldn't be information that Gandalf would get from Thran. I'm going to go with that. The reason I said this was tricky is as I was saying this, I started to think that maybe the most likely scenario is that they'll film it and then it will end up getting cut and then it will go back into the extended edition.
And we won't find out who got the prediction right until another year is passed.
That's right.
Yes. Yeah. And the DVD comes out.
Yeah, that is a good point. It's for some of these things where it's like, will it be in there or not? It's going to be hard to. We may actually have to revise our score tallies when the
exactly
the
or
DVD.
Have a preliminary and a
yeah,
later.
It's show. Like, well, it wasn't in the theater. So and right. maybe moving forward, I'm going to have to make all the questions say in the theatrical release.
Right, in the theatrical release. Yes.
But for this one, we'll leave it. We're going to leave it. Or so let's ask that question. Do you think it will be in the theatrical release altogether?
I do. Okay. Again, I think it'll be short. I would expect not much. But I do think it'll be there.
All right. Well, okay, so if you don't object, I'm going to revise the question. That way when we send it to other people, we're going to ask to predict, we can say in the theatrical release. So I'm going to say in the theatrical release, no. We were going to see C, exposition from Thorin to others. So.
Okay.
Great. Okay. Very first question, and we don't agree.
Excellent. Yes. That
means that there will be a winner and a loser on this question.
That's right.
I suspect I will probably end up being the loser, but that's okay. I don't mind playing that role.
I mean, I think I can also see what you're saying. I mean, one thing that I think we can already see in the trailer is that obviously Thorin is going. We are going to get much more Thorin. Peter Jackson is clearly trying to make him a more complex character from the beginning. Thorin becomes a more complex character as the book develops. But as I say, in chapter one, he's just like this sort of snooty jerk who's looking down at Bilbo and being snide. There's a little bit more going on than that. But anyway, it's still, we don't get all that much from him. And obviously Peter Jackson is going to give us more. So I can imagine, putting this stuff in Thorin's mouth that it would kind of give us a little bit more and able to connect, especially since he's talking about, the capture and torture of his father. I mean, this could be a big sympathy thing, right? That, our hearts go out to the poor, suffering, dark and handsome Richard Armitage at the very beginning. I can totally imagine that.
Yeah.
Don't think that's what's going to happen, but I can imagine it.
Especially if they take this in the direction that I kind of expect they or wonder if they might, which we'll get into on a future episode, which is the relationship between the Necromancer and Smaug. If they they decide to go the route of trying to connect the Necromancer to the larger story, maybe this will go from just reclaiming the quest will go from just reclaiming the Lonely Mountain from Smaug to getting vengeance on all of these people that these evil people that have been conspiring against them. So, but more on that in a future episode.
Yes, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Okay, good. Well, I think that's all the time we have this morning, but
yep.
that was a fun discussion. And we didn't really settle the question of Thror, so we might have to come back to Thror and the Battle of Azanulbazar
we're definitely coming back. We're going to spend a whole episode on the Battle of Azanulbazar because that is one of the most frickin'. I want to talk about the burned dwarves.
That's on my list of phrases that I hope to hear in the dialogue of The Hobbit is the phrase burned dwarf.
I
definitely want a reference to burned dwarf.
Even if it's just one of the 13 dwarves in passing, just mentioning that some forefather of his was a burned dwarf. And we don't know what he's talking
throw
about.
Throw us a bone. Come on. Throw us a bone. Yeah, throw like the diehard Tolkien geeks a bone. Absolutely. That would be fantastic.
Cool.
Great, good. Well, more stuff to come. We're planning to do this about bi-weekly, so and this will be the time slot that we'll do it live, so people can kind of be anticipating that for next time.
And I'm hoping for a fast turnaround on editing. I expect today I'm going to have to go do a tiny bit of editing at the beginning since we had that awkward thing where we started the podcast and we weren't broadcasting.
Yes.
So I have to edit that out. But apart from that, I'm just going to put this thing out the way it was. So we should get a fast turnaround. Hopefully this one will be up by tomorrow or at least by the end of the week. And then moving forward, it'll be will maybe be up the afternoon of the day of the recording. So, so I guess people should keep their eyes open let's make sure we at the end of this always get in our pitches as well. Obviously, people should keep their eyes open on Mythgard.org because that's where the site for this podcast is going to be, and that will be Riddles in the Dark Central. And it's going to be more than just hosting the podcast files and some, blah. It's going to be extra material beyond the podcast, and that's where people are going to be able to learn more about this prediction game we're doing. The exciting part of that, of course, is that we're going to be inviting people to join us and run a little competition between various individuals who are Hobbit and Tolkien pundits out there. So announcements for that will be on the Mythgard.org site, right? We'll probably I don't know if we'll set up a separate Twitter account or if we'll just use the Tolkien Professor and Mythgard ones, but what are the Tolkien Professor and Mythgard Twitter accounts?
The Tolkien Professor one is just Tolkien Prof, actually. Mm-hmm. Tolkien Professor having been a little bit too long. And my Facebook page and the Mythgard Twitter feed is Mythgardian. Mythgardian.
Right. And of course, Mythgard classes, the spring semester has launched, right?
That's right.
Very exciting.
We just had our first class for my Lewis and Tolkien class last night. We had our first session, which was a lot of fun. We spent a lot of time talking about Tolkien's Narnia issues and what exactly Tolkien objected to about Narnia and why he didn't like it very much. So that was
awesome.
A lot of fun.
Cool.
And we're already beginning planning towards some really exciting classes this summer and some brand new Mythgard programs that we're developing for the summertime. So
good,
lots of fun stuff going on there.
Yep. All right. Well, and of course, the other place you can get announcements about this podcast will be at the Middle Earth Network sites. Go to radio.mymiddle-earth.net and also the press releases announcing sort of our larger plan would be at news.mymiddle-earth.net. And I expect we'll be doing our press releases probably later this week, right, Corey?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, once we've had time to get the site up and everything ready and stuff. So, keep your eyes open we haven't chosen a topic for 2 weeks from now. We'll announce that later.
Yes, that's right.
All right. That's right. Well, Corey, I'm going to let you take us out.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for listening and Godspeed.